history and literature at Yale University. Among the other positions that he has served at, he has been visiting professor of Jewish history at Harvard University, visiting professor of Bible at Hebrew University, and he has also been visiting scholar in Jewish law and ethics at the Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. He is the author of The Canonization of Hebrew Scripture, editor of the Canon and Masorah of the Hebrew Bible, and has contributed articles to the Encyclopedia Britannica, Encyclopedia of Judaica, and Encyclopedia. Among the other positions that he has served at, he has been visiting professor of Jewish history at Harvard University, visiting professor of Bible at Hebrew University, and he has also been visiting scholar in Jewish law and ethics at the Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. He is the author of The Canonization of Hebrew Scripture, editor of the Canon and Masorah of the Hebrew Bible, and has contributed articles to the Encyclopedia Britannica, Encyclopedia of Judaica, and Encyclopedia Mikraic. He earned his doctorate from the Department of Oriental Studies at the University of Pennsylvania and his rabbinic ordination from the Miri Yeshiva in New York. And now I'd like to present Dr. Schneur Weinman.
Yeshua Rav, Moravi Asura, Rabbi Polkowitz, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great honor for anyone to be invited before this group and asked to speak at the White Shul. It is a special privilege for me to be invited to speak in the White Shul since, as some of you know, Far Rockaway is my hometown, and here I was raised, and it was the White Shul that my parents selected for me as the shul where we would daven. Indeed, the last time I spoke in the White Shul was on my bar mitzvah, when I delivered a drasha of sorts, a sermon, before Musaf in the main shul. It was the old White Shul on Dinsmore and Namio. I spoke for only 2 minutes then, and it must have left an indelible impression because I was not invited back for some 35 years. Since I plan to speak for close to an hour this evening, this is clearly the last time I will ever be speaking in a White Shul. In order to do justice to tonight's topic, it will be necessary to begin with some introductory material that will provide a general setting for the Emden Eibishitz controversy. We will then proceed to examine what I hope will prove to be two interesting episodes relating to the controversy. So this is going to be a kind of workshop, a hands-on workshop. I'm going to present evidence to you, and we will work together to try and understand the evidence as it relates to the controversy. You will get no more than a glimpse of the controversy, for it will require a lifetime of study, and indeed even more than that, in order to truly plumb the depths of this very explosive controversy. My intent is really to whet your appetites, and as we're told in the Gemara, the rest is commentary. Go and learn. On September 15, 1666, the Messianic pretender, Shabtai Tzvi, converted to Islam. With that single act, the more or less legitimate career of Shabtai Tzvi came to an end. But the messianic movement that he founded in the 17th century, and that had so gripped world Jewry, and the forces it had unleashed were so powerful that the movement would not die. Shabtai Tzvi had a prophet, Nathan of Gaza, and this prophet explained that the apostasy of Shabtai Tzvi was a profound mystery, a Kabbalistic secret, which, however, could be comprehended. Indeed, it was the Messiah's role to redeem the holy sparks that had fallen into the evil realm, the Nitzotzos, Hatoshos, that had fallen into the realm of the Klipot. So the Messiah himself had to convert to Islam, become a Muslim, in order to bring about the Messianic age. Shabtai Tzvi died in 1676. He was 50 years old at the time. The Messiah's death, before the redemption had run its course, needed to be accounted for. And Nathan of Gaza, who was not one to shy away from explanations when they were necessary and after the fact, he had one for this occasion as well. And he explained that Shabtai Tzvi, the Messiah, had not really died. He had been transformed into part of the Godhead. He joins the spheros, the Kabbalistic spheros. And so the spirit of Shabtai Tzvi was alive even after his death. Nathan of Gaza died some 4 years later in 1680, and his successors would work out the details of this new view of Shabtai Tzvi as Mashiach, even after he was an apostate, even after he had died. There were lots of questions that had to be answered among Jews. Would there be a second coming of the Mashiach, this particular Mashiach, Shabtai Tzvi? Were all Jews supposed to convert to Islam, as did their so-called Messiah? Or was this something only the Mashiach was supposed to do, not his followers? Were Jews still supposed to observe all the laws, fast on all the fast days? Shabtai Tzvi and Nathan of Gaza had abolished the four standard fasts, including Tisha B'Av. They became festivals while Shabtai Tzvi was alive. What should be done after Shabtai Tzvi had died? These were all critical issues that groups of Jews faced toward the end of the 17th century. And there were many different responses to these answers, leading to the formation of different groups of Sabbatean Jews, groups of Jews who still believe that Shabtai Tzvi was the Mashiach even after he had died. The largest group of such Sabbateans were clearly the moderate Sabbateans. This was a group consisting of Rabbanim, among others, leading Rabbanim in Turkey, in Italy, and in Poland. Outwardly, these were Orthodox rabbis. They had a beard. They wore payas and so on. There were Shomer Torah and mitzvahs. You could not differentiate these Jews from any other Jews in your community or in your shul. But secretly, they believed that Shabtai Tzvi was the Mashiach and that he was about to reappear in a second coming. This group tended to be a group of ascetics. They fasted. They said all sorts of tikkunim. They recited Tehillim, all in order to bring about the quick second coming of the Mashiach. Other more radical groups included groups of Jews who dressed like frum Jews, again, beards, payas, frum women, davening in the same shoes with all other groups of Jews, but they also were believers of Shabtai Tzvi, but they were radical believers of Shabtai Tzvi. And this radicalism expressed itself in the belief that just as Shabtai Tzvi lived in duplicity, that is, outwardly he lived as a Muslim. Secretly, even after he converted, he continued to be a Jew. That was part of the Kabbalistic secret of Shabtai Tzvi. so too these Jews believe that outwardly they have to be from Jews, and secretly they violated Torah and mitzvahs. So these Jews held it was a mitzvah to eat chalev, a mitzvah to eat forbidden fats. Those parts of animals that may not be consumed, they consumed and they recited a bracha before they consumed it. And the bracha was, Asher Kedishanu, Mitzav Tzivanu, Matir Isurim. Kadosh Baruch Hu is Matir Isurim. And that was how they were proving they were living in the Messianic age. They were followers of Shabtai Tzvi. And since they were living in Yemos HaMashiach, somehow the mitzvahs would no longer apply, Kavonos, Asid Kavonos, Libatel, and so on. They took those principles and applied them to many, many mitzvahs. Give you a sample of how serious this was. I'm going to cite only one bit of testimony at this early stage. This is from a Vias Avis before a Beis Din in Poland. It was a rabbinic court met in Poland and heard testimony from religious men and women. And I'll read the original and then I'll briefly translate it to English. We actually have the record. This is a court record from the middle of the 18th century. I want you to realize what time frame now. We're long after the death of Shabtai Tzvi. We're now in the 18th century. Bimosa Plosa, before a Beis Din of three, sitting as one, a woman came, Ma'isha Chaya, Hodes Bifanenu, Acharvidu, Yubchios Harbe, Shev. Zinso im Leibush kama pa'amim, v'im Hirsch kama pa'amim, v'im Lei ben Yishaya, v'isha reizel eshes, haniskol amala hodeis b'faneinu b'vidu, yubichios harde, zihat mizane gewesen, im Leibush kama pa'amim, v'im Hirsch kama pa'amim, v'im Lei kama pa'amim, hakol v'ratzon ba'ala, she'omar lo, ze mitzvah. This is a poor testimony of women who came and admitted that they had engaged in extramarital sexual relations, in promiscuous relations, and they did so, and they're sorry they did so. They tearfully testified to this effect. They thought they had done well because their husbands told them it was a mitzvah to do this. It was a mitzvah to do this only among groups of Sabbateans, especially the radical Sabbateans that I just described. Other such radical groups included a group in Salonika called the Dunmeh. This was a group that followed Shabtai Tzvi closely. They converted to Islam as a group, but secretly remained Jews. This group was founded during the lifetime of Shabtai Tzvi, and shortly before World War I, there were some 10,000 to 15,000 members of the Dunmeh still alive. And there are Dunmeh alive today, even in the United States. There's a group of Dunmeh who meet regularly in Washington, D.C. The Shabtai Tzvi movement has not died yet. Another of the more famous groups that you may have heard about, perhaps the most notorious of such radical Sabbatean groups, were the Frankists, headed by Jacob Frank in the 18th century. This group, for the most part, would ultimately convert to Christianity or assimilate to Christianity. And to the best of my knowledge, there are no Frankists alive today. That is, who still practice their Sabbatean beliefs. This group was particularly notorious for its nihilism, for its antinomianism. They were anti-halacha, anti-law, and broke every law in the book, teaching bitula, zui kiyuma, to be mevatel the mitzvos, is to be mekayim the mitzvos, following a radical Sabbatean teaching. For our purposes tonight, all you need to know, and that's why I'm beginning with this introductory material, is we need to realize that long after Shabtai Tzvi died, and we're going to be focusing on the 18th century, in the 18th century, Sabbateanism was alive and well and thriving. For the most part, it went underground. in the 18th century, making it particularly difficult to identify anyone as a Sabbatean. You never knew whether the person sitting next to you in shul was a Sabbatean or not. And even if you could identify someone perhaps as being a Sabbatean, it was very difficult to know which group of Sabbateans you belonged to. The most radical, the moderates, and so on. And obviously it would be the radical Sabbateans that were talked about the most, and inevitably, whenever someone was identified as a Sabbatean, it would be a simple matter to accuse him of being the worst kind of Sabbatean. I mean, that kind of Sabbatean who was radical and secretly violating all of the laws of the Torah. For Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who we'll be coming to shortly, there was no such thing as a moderate Sabbatean. All Sabbateans were radical, all were to be wiped off from the face of the earth. And let me tell you also, before I go further, that indeed it is to the credit of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, whatever else you may think after you leave tonight, it is Rabbi Yaakov Emden more than anyone else who rid the Jews of the Sabbatean heresy. He paid a heavy price for it, and a lot of other famous people, and famous Gedolim, paid a heavy price for what Rabbi Yaakov Emden did. But indeed, the credit goes, if there are no Sabbateans today, in this night, in this room, the credit goes to Rabbi Yaakov Emden. The 18th century was an incredible century for the Jews, indeed for the Goyim as well. It was a very productive century. There were no major persecutions of Jews in the 18th century. So there was no Khmelnytsky massacre, there were no pogroms such as the Jews had known in the 17th century. For most of the 18th century, the emancipation had not yet set in, so that modernity for the Jews was still around the corner. So the devastating effects of apostasy, assimilation, that, for example, German Jewry knew in the 19th century, was not yet here in the 18th century. Under the relatively serene conditions of the 18th century, the Jews would produce an array of major intellectuals and founders of movements. And so I'm going to pick at random now 12 names of Jews who lived in the 18th century, and it'll obviously be striking. The Baal Shem Tov lives in Mezhivitch. Reb Dov Ve'er Mezerich, his successor, the Maggid of Mezerich, lives in the 18th century. Reb Shneur Zalman, the Baal HaTanya, founder of the Chabad movement, lives for the most part in the 18th century. So the great founders of Hasidus appear in the 18th century. Parallel to that development in Vilna in the 18th century is none other than the Vilna Gaon, who was born and dies in that century. In Prague, capital of Bohemia in the 18th century, you tell me, who's there? No, the Behuda, the Heskalanda. In Frankfurt, Germany in the 18th century? Later. You're right, but later. Pnei Yoshua. The Pnei Yoshua. Rabbi Yaakov Yoshua, the author of the Pnei Yoshua. Who, in this period, is recognized as the Godel Hador. In Metz, in the same time, the Chagas Aryeh, Rabbi Aryeh Leib of Metz. In Padua, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzako. In Livorno, the Chidor, Chaim Yosef Dovid Azulai. And in Berlin in the 18th century, the founder of another movement, Moses Mendelssohn. All these people live in the 18th century, and many of them know each other personally. And in the same century, Rav Yaakov Emden, and Rabbi Yonason Ivershitz. It is, as I say, an absolutely incredible century. And in light of what I just said, I want to bring to your attention a passage of the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer would live his last years in the 19th century. But he once turned to a Talmud of his, Rabbi Yehuda Modern, and he told him as follows, Shemidor Hamidbar, Lohoya Kolkach Dor Deya, Kemohador Shel Rabbeinu Yonas and Ibishis. From the generation of the Midbar, the wilderness, the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, until the 18th century, there never had been a generation where so many Gdolei Yisrael lived together simultaneously. Notice that includes the Talmudic period. One generation with so many giants living at the same time. Vim lohoyos horibos umachlokes, and had it not been for the controversy that we're going to talk about tonight, as I beta choyos hagu'ula shlema, there is no question that the Mashiach would have come in the 18th century. So the Chassam Sofer, writing in the 19th century. It's no accident that God blessed that century with great individuals. This was true not only Jewishly, but non-Jewishly as well. 18th century was the century that saw Immanuel Kant in Germany, Voltaire and Diderot in France, and even in our own country here, people of the ilk of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Thomas Paine. And there are many more that one can add. Let me say a few words now about the protagonists, Rabbi Yonas and Ivershitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden, just so that you have the necessary information about their personal lives. Rabbi Yonas Ivershitz was born in Poland in 1690. He descended from great rabbis, mother's side, on his father's side. He was a great grandson of the Megala Amukos, a great Kabbalist who lived in Krakow. His father was a rabbi and he moved to Ivershitz, a town in Moravia, where he became of Bezin of Ivershitz, and he died when Rabbi Yonas was 12 years old. Rabbi Yonas was a child prodigy. He was taken to Vienna where he studied under Rabbi Shushan Wertheimer. He was then sent to several other yeshivos, Meir Eisenstadt and others. Ultimately married into a prestigious Prague family in 1710. His father-in-law was a chief rabbi and was able to provide for the son-in-law so that he could learn Torah. In 1713, Jonas Ivershitz went with his wife to Hamburg, Germany, where he studied in a kollel for 2 years. He returned in 1714 to become Darshan of Prague at a very early age. And there he would remain for many years. He never would become chief rabbi of Prague. He was Darshan of Prague when the chief rabbi died. His name was Rav David Oppenheim. Rabbi Yonas became Rosh Beis Din, but not chief rabbi, but he functioned as it were as the Av Beis Din for many years, until in 1742 he was called to Metz, the most prestigious rabbinate of the 18th century, and he became chief rabbi of Metz, succeeding the Bnei Yoshua, who left Metz for Berlin. He was a Rosh Yeshiva, aside from being Darshan, he was the outstanding Rosh Yeshiva of his age. Even Gratz, the historian, begrudgingly admits that Rabbi Yonas had over 20,000 students in his lifetime. Over 20,000 students who studied Talmud in his yeshiva. He was the greatest Rosh Yeshiva of his era, and that was some era. Let me assure you, there were many famous Rabbanim who none of us here have probably heard of, or barely heard of, who had they lived in any other century, would be among the great luminaries of all time. But Fortunately, they were born in the 18th century, and they couldn't even get a job, because look who you were competing with. It was, as I say, an incredible period. In the Hebrew University National Library, there's a list of 119 books by Rav Yonah Sinaiticus. And the most famous ones that many of you here look at various times are the Yaros Dvash, a very classic book of Drash, Urim V'Tumim, a commentary on the Choshen Mishpat, Praise You Placey, commentary on Yerodeah, and many, many more. There's an institute in Yerushalayim now, Machon Yerushalayim, that's publishing the Gesammelte Schriften, the collected writings of Rav Yonah Sinaiticus, in a critical edition. He is and remains one of the greatest Jewish minds of all time. I have a little sefer at home where a Talmud of Rav Meir Simcha Vinsk writes that he went to see Rav Meir Simcha in Vinsk, this is the beginning of the 20th century, and he caught Rav Meir Simcha learning the Crazy of Placey, that's one of Rav Yonah's Sinaiticus. And Rav Meir Simcha said, after studying that sefer, he said, never has a human mind reached a higher level in learning than this sefer of Rav Yonah Sinaiticus. Coming from Rav Meir Simcha, that's quite a compliment. Rav Yaakov Emden was born in Altona. Altona is a town which today is part of Hamburg, Germany, but then it was a separate town just outside of Hamburg, Germany, and belonged to the Kingdom of Denmark. He was born in Altona in 1697, so he was some 7 years younger than Rav Yonah Sinaiticus. He was the eldest son of the Chacham Tzvi, the Tzvi Ashkenazi, and he too, of course, was descended from many great rabbis on both sides of the family. You should remember that Rav Yaakov Emden's grandfather served as chief rabbi of Altona, his mother's father. When his grandfather died, his father succeeded to the chief rabbinate of Altona. And Rav Yaakov Emden, who was born in Altona and would live in Altona almost his entire life, never was elected chief rabbi of Altona. But a man by the name of Rav Yonah Sinaiticus did get the post in 1750. We'll come back to that a little later. Rav Yaakov Emden essentially was a balabas. He served only for a short while, for 3 years, as rabbi of a little port town in Germany called Emden, near the border with Holland. He was not made for the rabbinate. He himself admitted it. Retired from the rabbinate and went into business. He made a living from business investments throughout his life. And he was a balabas. He was simply a citizen, a Jew who lived in the city of Altona, where Rav Yonah Sinaiticus was the chief rabbi. In 1715, Rav Yaakov Emden married a woman, as he himself tells us, a woman that his father had selected to be his bride. He was not impressed with his wife. And indeed, despite the fact that he idolized his father, he held his father accountable for having selected this woman as his wife. He was quite bitter about it. In any event, he was 17 years old when he married. He would move to Moravia for a while. His father died the same year that he married, eventually coming to Emden, where he served as rabbi. In 1733, he returns to his hometown, Altona, where he remains until his death in 1776. Rav Yaakov Emden, too, is one of the greatest Gaonim of the 18th century, and indeed of all time. He has left us many, many brilliant works, perhaps the most famous of which is his Siddur Rav Yaakov Emden, which the Chasam Sofer would say, again in the 19th century, that it is the best page ever written on the Siddur. Chasam Sofer calls Rav Yaakov Emden in one of his chuvas, in Chelek Vav of Shalos and Chuvas Chasam Sofer, he says Rav Yaakov Emden is a Navi, he calls him a prophet, a title he gives no one else. Rav Yaakov Emden wrote a parish in Mishnayis called Lechem Shamayim. He wrote a commentary on the Tur called Moruch Sia. He wrote Shalos and Chuvas, Shalos Yavas, and many, many more Sfarim. I'm simply reciting some of the highlights. He married three times. His first two wives died. He buried 11 children in his lifetime, and he was blind in his old age. He suffered. He was a very unhappy man his entire life. I didn't mention one of the sefer that he wrote, of the many that he did write. It's worth mentioning a sefer called Megillah Sefer, an autobiography. He is one of the few, Gedolei Yisrael in all of Jewish history, that wrote an autobiography. And in this autobiography, long before the 20th century, he lets it all hang out. He lets you know how he feels about anyone and everyone, including his wife, children, father, and so on. And if you read that book, you read the book of essentially a misanthrope, someone who in one of his letters writes that for 20 years I have not left my room, and I just detest going out and seeing people. I stay in my house and I learn Yomim Valayim. That's what he does. These are the two protagonists that we're going to be discussing. Rabbi Yaakov Emden was in Altona in the year 1750, been living there for quite a while. There was only one shul in Altona. Any of you familiar with the structure of Jewish communities in the 18th century and earlier, you will know that in a typical town there was a shul, and there was one rav, and there was one community, and there was a president of the shul, and there were tovei ha'ir, and there were rules and regulations, and if you made a bar mitzvah, you could only invite X number of people, you could only wear certain kinds of clothes, and if you didn't follow the rules, you were fined. That was a different world then. This is all the pre-emancipation, the pre-modern world where the Jew could do as he pleases. Well, Rabbi Yaakov Emden had one difficulty. He didn't get along well with other Jews. How was he going to daven in shul with so many other Jews? So Rabbi Yaakov Emden petitioned the Balabatim of Altona in the 1730s, almost as soon as he moved in, and he was granted permission, because he was such a great gadol, granted permission, and he was the only one that was granted permission, to establish a minyan in his house. Only a minyan. And so 10 Jews were allowed to daven in Rabbi Yaakov Emden's house, so that Rabbi Yaakov Emden didn't have to walk to the main shul and sit and listen to the rabbi darshan every Shabbos. In 1750, Rabbi Yonah Snivishitz was elected by acclamation chief rabbi of Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek. Ahu is called. Altona and the nearby major city Hamburg and another town, Wandsbek, I guess to save money, pooled their funds, and they would hire one chief rabbi to serve as rabbi of all three communities. He was a very distinguished rabbinate. The prior incumbent had been the Knesset Yeheskel, another great rabbi who I can't even list as one of the great rabbis of the 18th century, because the list will go on forever. He didn't even get into the top 12. But also a great postache of that century. He dies in 1749. There's an election. Rabbi Yaakov Emden is a candidate. Well, not elected, but Rabbi Yonah Snivishitz is elected in 1750. As rabbi of Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek. Rabbi Yonah Snivishitz is 60 years old when he comes to Altona with his family, one of the greatest gedolim, one of the greatest Rosh Hashivas in the world. It is incredible that from September 1750 until September 1764, a period of some 15 consecutive years, these two titans lived around the corner from each other in Altona. I visited their homes. Around the corner from each other in Altona. And in those 15 years, they saw each other once. And they both deeply regretted the one time they saw each other. In a community in Altona that could not have had more than 200 families, they never attended the same bris, the same wedding, or the same funeral. And they engaged in a controversy that not only shook Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek to the core, one that would become an international cause celeb. It's a And the controversy, by the way, did not end with the death of Rav Yonah Stanivesius in 1764. It did not even end with the death of Rav Yaakov Emden in 1776. It has continued through the ages, and indeed will continue to be debated, mostly by scholars, thank God, at this point, so long as Jews continue to revere the names of Rav Yonah Stanivesius and Rav Yaakov Emden. I said I was going to bring you into the workshop of what historians do, so I want you now to see some evidence and begin the first of two episodes that we're going to investigate so that we can get a handle on what this controversy is all about.
Could I ask you perhaps to
okay, if I could have your attention. The controversy erupted on a fateful Thursday morning. It was February 4, 1751, when Rav Yaakov Emden announced in his shul, in his minyan, in his house, that he had read a kameya, an amulet, that had been written by the chief rabbi, Rav Yonason, aside from being Rosh Yeshiva, and aside from being Darshan, was internationally renowned for being a Baal Shem. He was called Rav Yonason Baal Shem in many documents. He was a Baal Shem, indeed, as Yisrael Baal Shem Tov meant, someone who knows how to write kameis and amulets, someone who uses the Shem Hashem to heal people. When women were in dangerous childbirth or sick, or children were sick, it was common practice in Jewish communities to go to a great tzaddik, specifically to a Baal Shem, and ask the Baal Shem to write a kameya. A kameya would be a usually Kabbalistic formulae, a tefillah of some sort to Hashem, asking that this woman, this child, this man be healed or be kept safe. Rav Yonason was an acknowledged expert. He's a great Mekubal, and he wrote Kameis. Rav Yaakov Emden announced that Thursday morning right at Kriyas HaTorah. He banged, gave a bang on the table, an eyewitness account of this. Rav Yaakov Emden announced he had just read a Kameya written by the chief rabbi, Rav Yonah Stanivesius. And the Kameya that he read could only have been written by a believer in Shabsai Tzvi. Therefore, he accuses the chief rabbi, the greatest Rosh Yeshiva of the 18th century, of being a secret member of the Sabbatim group. At the height of the controversy in 1756, Rav Yaakov Emden published a pamphlet in Altona. Rav Yaakov Emden had a printing press in his house. Whenever he was sufficiently angry or had other cause, he would print a little pamphlet, which is one reason why you shouldn't have a printing press in your house, if you can help. And he printed a whole series of pamphlets and volumes against Rav Yonah Stanivesius. I might say, before we go further, that of course Rav Yonah responded. You can imagine the tension that there was in Altona. Families split. Brothers and sisters didn't speak to each other. Some took the side of Rav Yonah Stanivesius, some took the side of Rav Yaakov Emden. Fist fights broke out regularly in the shul. We have German newspapers from the 18th century the stock market was closed in Hamburg, Germany one day because the Jews were engaged in fistfights on the floor of the stock market over the end of the Eichmann's controversy. It would involve, of course, all the Rabbanim of the 18th century, including many of the names that I had mentioned earlier. And they took sides. Some took sides with Rav Yonason, some took sides with Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden put Rav Yonason Avishitz in Tehran, because he believed he was a Shabtzai Tzvinik. Rav Yonason Avishitz put Rav Yaakov Emden in Tehran. We ever heard of a Balabas putting the chief rabbi in Tehran? All rabbis took sides. So those on Rav Yaakov Emden's side put all the rabbis on Rav Yonason's side in Tehran, and vice versa.
answer is about 200 families. I figure about 4 people or 5 people in the family.
All right.
At the height of the controversy in 1756, the pamphlet was published. It was 14 pages, I believe. And you have the last page of the pamphlet in front of you. And due to the miracle of modern Xeroxing, this is clearer than the original. So if you think it's not clear, I would say this is quite an improvement of the original. I brought with me one typical Sefer published by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, printed in his own printing press. These are very rare and very valuable. I'll pass this around and I'll ask that you give it back to me before. This particular pamphlet, the last page of which you have in front of you, is called Pesach Einayim. It was a devastating critique of Rabbi Yechezkel Landau, of the Noda B'Yehuda, by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, because the Noda B'Yehuda had, as it were, taken sides and defended Rabbi Yonos and Ibishitz. Anyone who defended an enemy of Rabbi Yaakov Emden became the enemy of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. So this particular pamphlet is a pamphlet against the Noda B'Yehuda. It should not come as a surprise at this point that Rabbi Yaakov Emden accused the Noda B'Yehuda of being a Shabsai Tzvina, a secret member of the Shabsai Tzvina. Otherwise, why would he defend Rabbi Yonos and Ibishitz? Actually, the Noda B'Yehuda tried to bring out a pshara. Noda B'Yehuda, being the great tzaddik that he was, seeing that European Jewry, European Orthodoxy, and specifically the rabbinic leadership, was literally falling apart. Everybody's in Kerem, the message that everybody got, that I'm sure it wasn't lost on the Balabatim, was that Kerem means nothing. It was a great Chilul Hashem, and so the Noda B'Yehuda made a major effort and a brilliant effort to trying to reconcile these two Rabbanim before they tore all the Judaism apart. He failed. That's the story for another lecture. This was Rabbi Yaakov Emden's response. Anyway, Rabbi Yaakov Emden succeeded in torpedoing the efforts of the Noda B'Yehuda. Indeed, he succeeded in torpedoing any efforts that anybody made to settle the controversy. And so, as I indicated, it was never really resolved. And even after all the major parties died, people are still debating who is right and who is wrong. Rabbi Yonos and Ibishitz was married. He had only one wife. It was a beloved wife. Her name was Elkala. She had been his wife for some 45 years. Accompanied him to Altona, and she died in 1755 when, after a lengthy battle, she succumbed to cancer. Elkala's first Yahrzeit had barely passed when a vicious attack against her husband and pertaining to her epitaph, to the inscription on her tombstone, appeared in this Sefer, Pesach Einayim, and published by Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Now I'd like to read it together with you. So if you'd hold the page in front of you, where I have the arrow on the page, where I'll be reading. This will give you a sense of the controversy. This is Rabbi Yaakov Emden speaking. L'man har'os, ki efshalo l'tov shum ksiva mibli ezer remez min haminus, in order to prove to you that Rabbi Yonos and Ibishitz cannot write anything, he can't put anything into print, without referring to Shabsai Tzvi, without a reference to the heresy, I'm going to present here Od Eze Tzivos, some inscriptions, writings of Rabbi Yonos and Ibishitz, Sheyotsu Mitachas Yidei Hatoev Habnis Kolomala, that were written by Rabbi Yonos. Eilu HaCharuzim, this is the poem, Shehitzig al Matsevas Ishto, that he inscribed on Elkula's tombstone, Matsevas Oven. This is a typical clever play of words by Yaakov Emden. Matsevas Oven. Oven should be Aleph Beis Nun, a stone matseva. But notice he spells it Aleph Vav Nun, a stone of sin. And now look to the right column, the right part, and we'll do the best we can. This is exactly as it appears in the original. As I say, it's even clearer here. Yud Teves. So obviously she died on Asara B'Teves. Yud Teves. Nefach L'Gvai U'L'Kina. The 10th of Teves turned into a day of mourning. Shira L'Frat Kotam. In the year Shira, Shin Yud Resh Hei, the Gematria will add up to the Christian year 1755. The Hebrew year 5,550. Ateres Rosh, and this of course is written by Rabbi Yonason Abishitz, his wife died. Obviously, Rabbi Yonason wrote the Matzeh. Ateres Rosh, Nafla, the crown of my head has fallen. The Nomes, Leva, the heart melts away. Livyas, Chain, ornament of grace, Harabonis, Hachmonis, Tzikonis, the Rebbetzin, the wise and righteous, Moras Elkula, Bas Koter, Shalshelas, Hayachas Elkula, the daughter of the crown of Yuchas, she has Yichas, she comes from the chain of great Yuchasin, Hagon Habodol, Harab Hagon, Moreni Yitzchak Shapira, the daughter of Yitzchak Shapira, Rosh L'Kahal Hashem, who was a Jewish chief rabbi of Moravia. Lekucha Isha, and she, namely the woman buried here, Lekucha, she was married to Isha L'Harab Agon, Moreno Harab Rabbeinu Yonason, of Bezdin the Gimel Kehilos, chief rabbi of the three communities, Ahu, Alfana Hamburg Vansbeck, Ugrilo Soretz, and all the surrounding communities. Now what follows is not altogether clear, but Rove, it should be Shevach, the next word, the Shevach, Schus Masa, the good deeds that she did, the merit of all the good deeds that she did, the Tov, Pa'ala, all the wonderful deeds, Livli Mispar, without number, the Tov, the Tzror Chaim, also, that the merit of all the good deeds allow her to go up into heaven, the Tzror Chaim, to Gan Eden, let her rest forever in that awesome and beautiful place named Gan Eden. This is what the Yaakov Emden printed. Now, what does this have to do with, where is there any reference here? So, you see, yes? Left, look at the left-hand column of that Matseva, the letters that are printed in large print, and you see Shin Beis Sof Yud Sadi in large letters. Shapsai Sadi. And here was Rabbi Yaakov Emden saying, but Yaakov Emden said, look, he said, all you have to do is look at the tombstone. There it is in letters that you can't miss. Shapsai Tzvi. Now his point was, or Yaakov Emden's point was, that just as the letters on the right side of the inscription, look at the letters on the right side, where it might be a little more difficult for you to see, spells Elkula, which is common practice. When you write a Nusach on a Matseva, you would write out an acrostic using the name of the person. So if you look at the letters on the left side, they spell out Shapsai Tzadi. Clearly, Rav Yonas and Ivershitz was proclaiming his Sabbatian belief for all to see. Now the Pesach Einayim was published in Altona, as I said, in 1756. It was distributed to all members of the community. It was sent all over the world. Rav Yonason Abishitz is living in Altona and is the chief rabbi of Altona. This was an astonishing claim. And in effect, what Rav Yaakov Emden was saying is that the chief rabbi's heresy was engraved on the tombstone for all to see. If you had any doubts, all you had to do was walk into the cemetery, if you weren't a Kohen, and you could take a look, see for yourself. Now, a cautious reader, perhaps a defender of Rav Yonason, may wish to claim that, wait a minute, maybe Rav Yaakov Emden deliberately printed those letters, Shin, Beis, Kaf, Yud, in block letters to create the impression that we have a Shabsai Tzadi over here. Perhaps on the tombstone they were just ordinary sized letters. Anybody, I mean, we could, anybody here can condemn anybody he wanted if he wanted to go to a cemetery and start creating block letters. I mean, that's no trick. Such a claim can't even be entertained, because Rav Yaakov Emden was a great gaon, and let me assure you, he was not a fool. Rav Yaakov Emden would not have published a document like this in the lifetime of every member of the community who could immediately walk to the cemetery and take a look, and they'll see that there isn't a Shin Beis Kaf Yud. And then Rav Yaakov Emden would be disproven. That would be even impossible to imagine that Rav Yaakov Emden would do anything like that. Clearly, Rav Yaakov Emden was presenting a reasonably accurate transcription of this epitaph as it appeared on the tombstone. And he transcribed regular-sized letters in regular-sized print and large-sized letters in block print. I can prove the point by referring you to elsewhere in Rav Yaakov Emden's writings, where he refers again to this epitaph. And in 1769, in the Sefer that's circulating now, Rav Yaakov Emden published another volume against Rav Yonason Eibeshitz. Notice 1769, 5 years after Rav Yonason is dead, Rav Yaakov Emden is still writing Sfarim against Rav Yonason Eibeshitz. And in there, he regurgitates the whole matter of the epitaph, and this time he writes as follows. In 1755, Rav Yonason's wife died from breast cancer. He had an epitaph inscribed on her tombstone, in which, by means of an acrostic, he alluded to Shabsai Tzvi. He alluded to the year of her death by using the word Shiro, Shin Yud Reish Hei. He enlarged the Shin. Who's he? Rav Yonason enlarged the Shin so that it would connect to the final letters of the words directly below it. As you see, under the Shin is a Beis, a Tav, and so on, in a straight line, so it would spell out the word Shabsai, unquote. So Rav Yaakov Emden. So clearly the enlarged letters were enlarged on the tombstone itself. And indeed, as late as 1769, 15 years after Elkanah's death, Rav Yaakov Emden was still claiming that the chief rabbi's heresy was engraved on the tombstone for all to see. Need your help again. In 1903, the rabbi of Altona, his name was Rabbi Dukas, published a history of all the rabbis of Altona. It included portraits of those rabbanim, and it included tombstone inscriptions. And I'm passing out to you now a copy, a photograph, as it were, of the tombstone inscription of Elkalah Eibeshitz. Now, what is striking as you look at it, is the lack of any enlarged letters. No letters are enlarged. In fact, you have neither Elkalah spelled out nor Shabsai Tzadi. And this same transcription of Elkalah Eibeshitz's epitaph appears in all later histories of the Emden Eibeshitz controversy and of the Eibeshitz family, including the definitive biography, a sefer called Gedulas Yonason, available in your bookstores today. To the best of my knowledge, nobody ever asked the question that I'm raising now with you, namely Hakadosh Rabbi Yaakov Emden has written what he wrote, and you have the photograph of the Pesach Einayim in front of you, you have this photograph in front of you. Obviously they're not the same. This requires explanation. Ein ze omer ela doshenu. Now, what would you suggest at this point? You have all the evidence in front of you.
This is a replacement.
Okay, good suggestion. What you're really saying is that probably the original tombstone was destroyed, and a new tombstone was instituted, and this was first photographed in 1903, gives you lots of time for a new tombstone. Why would someone institute a new tombstone? Somebody who wanted to get rid of the shin based stuff, good. All right. Okay, good guess. That's what I would have guessed. That's what I suspected. It's not right, but it's a good guess. Now, when I read all this, I suspected a cover up. I had lived through the Nixon era, you see. And, you see, if one examines the Pesach Einayim passage, the passage, the first page that I gave you, written by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, it's obvious that the right side of the tombstone spells out Elkula, and this is how tombstones were written, and certainly if it was written by a Gadol Yisrael like Rabbi Yonasan. Moreover, on the page that I gave you, next to Elkula's tombstone, you have Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz's epitaph, his tombstone, which he wrote himself. And here, too, we can learn from Dolei Yisrael. What a smart man he was. He wasn't going to let anybody write his tombstone for him. Right? So, as you can see, inscribed on the tombstone, it's a beautiful, beautiful tombstone. Nimsa b'tzav yad la'atzig al'atziyun. I'm not going to read it with you now, but you can read it on your own. It's a beautiful, beautiful matzev. But he left the tzavor, and he wanted this inscription on his tombstone, and he wrote a divrei musar, so that anyone who would ever come to the grave of Yonasan Eibeshitz would learn some lesson just by visiting his tombstone. But what do you see on the right-hand column? That's what's crucial for our purpose. Yonasan Zal. Obviously, it was his minig to write acrostics at the beginning of Matzeva. So I must say, on a priori grounds, for a man, okay. On a priori grounds, and Rabbi Yaakov Emden already gave me a copy of his wife's Matzeva, and that also had Elkula. So, I must say, it makes a lot of sense what Rabbi Yaakov Emden wrote. So I must say that, at least initially, I suspect that Rabbi Yaakov Emden may be presenting an accurate tombstone. And if so, the only explanation left for us is the one that was presented here by several of you, namely, but obviously, someone, perhaps a Talmud of Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz, had a yeshiva, anyone with 20,000 Talmudim, and worried about the covetous of Rebbe, ran out to the cemetery in the middle of the night, took an engraver with him. They removed that tombstone, they redid the inscription, and they redid it as we see it today. As bizarre as it sounds, that appears to be the only reasonable explanation. I suspected this, and I also worried a lot about it, because I've been spending many, many years studying this machlokes. And if it's true, if Rabbi Yaakov Emden was right, then it's incredible. Here's evidence, black on white, carved in stone, that Rabbi Yonasan believed in Shabtzai Tzvi. However, I can assure you that no such cover-up occurred. Certainly not during the lifetime of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Because what did I tell you before? In 1769, in the Sefer that's circulating now, he again spoke about this episode. Right? This is, what, 14 years later? 14 years after his first reference to it. And again he says that you can go out and look in the cemetery, you'll see. Obviously nobody ran out to the cemetery. And let me tell you, had somebody run out to the cemetery right after 1755, what do you think Rabbi Yaakov Emden would have written in 1769? With great glee, Rabbi Yaakov Emden would have written, look what they did! The Talmidim went in the middle of the night. I bet you Rabbi Yaakov Emden was waiting in the cemetery for many years to see whether somebody would come out here to redo the tombstone. What better proof than to catch them red-handed? But Rav Yaakov Emden doesn't say that in 1769. In 1769, Rav Yaakov Emden again says, all you have to do is look on the tombstone. The tombstone wasn't touched during the lifetime of Rav Yaakov Emden. And Rav Yonason died in 1764. If no one changed the tombstone during the lifetime of Rav Yonason and during the lifetime of Rav Yaakov Emden, you can be sure that no one changed that tombstone after 1769, which is long after the height of the controversy. Much like the fabled medieval debate concerning how many teeth a horse has, which you know all about that debate, and there was much learned discussion, and all the great medieval scholars adduced volume after volume. They brought down volumes and tomes from the library. Each one brought proofs that a horse has so many teeth, and others said this many teeth, and so on. And the matter wasn't resolved until one brilliant scholar hit upon the idea of examining a live horse's mouth. So I set out for Altona 2 years ago and visited the Jewish cemetery on the Königstrasse. The cemetery is still there, where Elkalah Eibeschütz rests in peace. Our tombstone still stands, and the epitaph is sufficiently legible so that the matter can be laid to rest. The first thing I did was examine the shape of the tombstone, the texture and its color, and compared it to other tombstones nearby of ordinary Jews, not famous rabbis and famous rabbis, but typical Jew who died in 1750, 60, or 1770. And when I did that, it was obvious that her tombstone was of the same stone, same cut, same color. The original tombstone is still there. And you can go, don't believe the word I say here, go to Altona, check it out. Okay. And I must say, when I first saw it, I was shocked. I also have to tell you that it was covered with moss. I had to remove several layers of green moss, other growths on the stone before I could get to the letters. But when I got to the letters and I could feel the letters, they protrude from the stone, I was shocked because I knew what I was looking for. You can imagine which letters I turned to first. And I found Shin, Beis, Tav, Yud, Sadi, and was amazed. But as I cleaned off the rest of the tombstone and copied the entire tombstone, and now I'm going to ask my two helpers to do the third page, and now we'll explain what really happened. Is a hand copy, a very precise copy of what the tombstone looks like. I obviously can't carve stone for you, but that's exactly and in exact place where every letter is on the tombstone. And alas, it turns out that Rav Yaakov Emden did not tell the whole truth, at least in 1756 when he published the Pesach Einayim passage. The letters and brackets on this third page that you have are no longer legible on the tombstone, but they have no bearing on our discussion, so it really doesn't matter. The enlarged letters are visible to the naked eye. You can see it when you're standing in front of the tombstone. And every enlarged letter has an enlarged stone dot on top of it, also protruding. So you shouldn't miss the point that it's a capital letter, a block letter. And I indicated those dots by dots on the page. On the hand copy that I just distributed, The enlarged letters are aligned one atop the other exactly as they appear on the tombstone. And what we need to note is the following. First, the enlarged letters read, we'll start with the right column, Elkele Zal. Elkele is a form of Brocha. Remember, look at Yonason. It says Yonason Zal on Yonason's tombstone. Elkele Zal is a form of Brocha. Bas Yitzchak Shapira. So look what a beautiful acrostic. It's an acrostic from two sides. And Rabbi Yonason wrote her name and her father's name. Elkele Zal Bas Yitzchak Shapira. The shin of Shira, Rabbi Yaakov Emden had said, he deliberately made the shin large. He didn't tell us that he made the Yud Resh Hay large like the shin. The whole word Shira is large because that's the year. Moreover, Rabbi Yaakov Emden said that the shin was on the top of the bait and they were all in a straight line, spelling Shabtzai Tzadi. Not true. It's exactly as you see a line here. And the shin is not on top of the bait. It doesn't even hint that it should be read that way. All it says is Elkele Zal Bas Yitzchak Shapira. But when Rabbi Yaakov Emden printed the pamphlet that he wrote, he realigned the letters slightly, and notice he didn't enlarge all the letters, just enough so you should see Shabtzai Tzvi, and therefore think that this is a reference to Shabtzai Tzvi. I took a camera with me, and it was a very difficult tombstone to photograph, but I photographed it, and I'll pass this around so you can actually see the evidence with your own eyes. I'll talk about it. Rabbi Yonason Ivershitz, Rabbi Yonason Ivershitz did not respond to this particular accusation, probably because no response was necessary. So this instance is perhaps appropriate to say about Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Lefisha Bo Lechlal Tos, Lechlal Kas, Bo Lechlal Tos. But I must say, one never knows for sure. Rabbi Yaakov Emden spent a whole lifetime persecuting secret Sabbateans, Jews who outwardly looked like they were from Jews, secretly they were Sabbateans. He developed radar-like capabilities in this area. And many of the people that Rabbi Yaakov Emden identified as Sabbateans have, in recent times, it's been established historically, without question, that in fact they were Sabbateans. Modern historians discovered letters they wrote and so on that support some of the contentions of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. And so one has to wonder if Rabbi Yaakov Emden, when he read this inscription of Elkele, wasn't troubled by the first line. Look at that first line. Yud Teves, Nefach Ledvayu Lekina, Shiro Lefrat Kota. The tenth of Teves has been changed into a day of mourning. What is the tenth of Teves? Sorry, Teves is a fast day. What do you mean, Nefach Ledvayu Lekina? What was before it was Nefach? And in 18th century Sabbatean teaching, as I already indicated, the 10th of Teves for the Yontov was a holiday. So only someone who ordinarily celebrated the 10th of Teves would presumably refer to it as a day that was Nefach Ledvayu Lekina, due to a death in the family. Why is this year called Shira? The year that someone dies, there are a lot of gematrias that you come up with for the year 515. Why call it Shira with that cousin? What was the Shira here? And the name Shira occurs in various Sabbatean records as a as representing Shabtzai, Yorum Hodo, as a reference to Shabtzai Tzvi. How would Rabbi Yonason Ivershitz have responded if these were the questions that would have been put to him? Well, I'm sure he would have had a good explanation. Perhaps he would have explained that what he intended to say that was that the 10th of Teves, which was just a mere fast day, but it was still a fast day, that year, in that particular year, the year Shira turned into a year of Kina and Vay. There are other possibilities as well. In any event, at least with regard to this one piece of evidence, and this is one piece of hundreds of pieces. I want you to get a sense of what this controversy is all about and the kinds of evidence that were put forward in the controversy. This is typical of the kind of evidence that was put forward. And at least with regard to this piece of evidence, there is no question that Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz is the victor in the Emden Eibeshitz controversy. No court would convict Rav Yonasan of heresy on the basis of the very thin and distorted evidence put forward by Rav Yaakov Emden in this instance. But of course, as I say, there was other kinds, there was much more evidence. This inquiry enables us to enter Rav Yaakov Emden's workshop. Despite his general penchant for accuracy, he wasn't always accurate. Letters that should have been enlarged were not enlarged in what he represented. Letters were aligned improperly in order to create a certain kind of impression. And all it would take to disprove Rav Yaakov Emden was a stroll in the cemetery. That's all it would take. Yet he published what he published anyway, in any event. One has to suspect, I told you earlier, Rav Yaakov Emden wrote once, that for a 20-year period he didn't leave his house. This was an alternate. One suspects that he published a hand copy that was presented to him. I doubt that he himself went to the cemetery. It was simply brought to him, and what was brought to him, he published. It might have been brought to him by a student of Rav Yaakov Emden himself. It was enough to publish immediately in order to create an impression. Anything goes if you're out to get someone that Rav Yaakov Emden already made up his mind was a Sabbatian. Throughout the controversy, Rav Yaakov Emden relied on hearsay and on materials submitted to him to others. And obviously, he didn't always verify what he heard. Now, let me explain briefly. We still have the question, why in 1903? Why in 1903 was this version of the Matseva published? Well, that's easy to explain for those of you looking at the picture that's circulating, or go back and look at the hand drawing that I drew for you. Several of the lines of the tombstone are half lines in the original. Take a look. They're half lines. Half the line is empty space. So on the tombstone. When the rabbi in 1903 published all the tombstones of rabbis and rebbetzins in the Altena Cemetery, he wasn't going to waste time and space with half lines. He collapsed 15 lines into 12 lines. All right? As soon as you collapse lines, you lose the acrostic. That's what happened here. It's as simple as that. It's not a cover-up. No, there he retained it. Because in Rav Yonasan's, there are no half spaces. No half spaces. Legend has it, with this I'll close tonight's discussion, that on his deathbed, 1776, as his neshama was departing, Rav Yaakov Emden was heard greeting his father, the Chacham Tzvi. This was immediately followed by Rav Yaakov Emden's last words as a mortal: "Greetings, Rav Yonasan." The imagery here is that of a departing soul greeting the souls on high. Upon his death, the Chevra Kadisha convened in Altona to settle on an appropriate gravesite for Rav Yaakov Emden. In the rabbinical section of the Königstrasse Cemetery in Altona, there was only one empty plot in the rabbinical section. It was five graves away, but in the same row as Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz. The members of the Chevra Kadisha were not prepared to bury these two rivals in proximity to each other. By chance, the Noda Yehuda was in Altona, and he happened to be visiting relatives at the time. And so the Chevra Kadisha went to the Noda Yehuda and asked him to decide the issue. And he ruled that since Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonah Sinaivish finally made peace with each other. Witness the fact that the last words of Rabbi Yaakov Emden were, "Greetings, Rabbi Yonah." So he ruled that it was appropriate that they be buried near each other. That's the legend, and it appears in Sfarim. Anyone who visits Altona today will be able to attest to the fact that this last part of the legend is certainly true. Rav Yaakov Emden is buried next to his third wife, Tzivya Rochel. Rav Yonason is buried next to his wife, Elkala, and both couples rest in peace in the same row, five graves apart from each other. Thank you very much.
Take questions for a few minutes. Anyone has?
Right.
I'm trying to understand this diagram here. I don't see Elko.
You're referring to the, yeah.
As I explained to you, the rabbi who in 1903 decided to copy over the tombstones in Altona, when he copied what he considered were the non-rabbis, he preserved the rabbinical tombstones exactly as they appear on the tombstones. The non-rabbis, he simply wrote as many words as he could fit in between the two lines. So he collapsed the lines, and with that you lose the process.
You explained what a wonderful door that was, how a wonderful golem or a wonderful and yet you described the controversy between a self-styled misanthrope, a person that left his house, who was a Baal Bas, essentially, who wrote a lot, and was a golem, but still, and who was able to divide the Gdol Hador into two camps by what you have shown to be faulty recriminations and accusations and against the Gadol Hador. I mean, how do you explain that occurred? I mean, I don't understand the whole controversy and how this went on to this day, you say.
Two quick answers. I tried to stress, and I'll repeat it again, that you're hearing just one piece of evidence. And that's right, but please don't decide the Vorim, the Rumbo Shalolam, on the basis of what you heard in one short discussion. There are worlds that need to be discussed here. Two things. One is, that's why I began with that general introductory material. I want you to understand what was happening in the 18th century. My point is, yes, innocence fell in this battle, like in any war, but there was a reason why it was fought. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden was a Kanoi, Ben Kanoi. It took a Kanoi to fight this war. He did, and he won. That's one that you have to realize. So realize the larger context. That account a little bit to what Rabbi Yaakov Emden did. The other part is, before you come to any decisions about these matters, realize that there's more evidence here than I've presented tonight, that I could possibly present in one night. And what I'll even say, I'm willing to go out this far on the limb and tell you that